Hello, hello. Welcome once again to Learning Digital Photography. I'm your host, Jason Anderson, and you are listening to episode number 34. On this week's show, we're mixing it up and we're adding a theme. And the theme for this week's show is the dial on your DSLR. Where do you put it? What does each mode do? Do you put it in auto? Do you put it in P? Do you put it in M? What do you do? What happens if you shoot an SLR in auto mode? Does that make it a point-and-shoot camera or does it not? What are the pros? What are the cons? We're going to answer that big question on today's show. Also coming up on today's show, we had a great chat with Matthew Bamberg earlier this week. Matthew Bamberg is a well-respected photographer and author. That was fun sitting down and talking with him, so we're going to share that conversation with you on this week's show. And last but not least, we're going to discuss some contests and listener questions and answers. All that's coming up right after this, so don't go away. Welcome back to Learning Digital Photography. So we're going to start things off with the subject of the dial. And what do you do with the dial on your SLR camera? And the reason why this came up, I'll tell you why this came up. This is kind of an interesting little story. It was my birthday last week, and many of you out there in the photography blogosphere and Twitter sphere and podcast sphere and the whole internet sphere has wished me happy birthday. Thank you very much to everyone for sharing your wonderful thoughts with me. I don't like turning 40, but I think I will just have to deal with it, seeing as the other option is to, well, not deal with it and bury my head in the sand. But anyway, the fun story about all this is that my wife took me out to dinner. We went out to dinner, and we were sitting down at a great Mexican restaurant here in Denver, just having a really great time. And I saw someone at a table behind me. And what they were doing is they're flashing their camera. And of course, being a photographer, like many photographers, you kind of turn your head and see what's going on, what all the hubbub is. And there was a party of probably about 25, 30 people all sitting at this table. And they were passing a point and shoot around, having a blast, taking pictures. Flash was going off. People were laughing and having fun. And it was just a really cool time. And then, in looking at this table behind me, I see a flash coming from behind me again. So I turn back around, and I see this guy shooting a Nikon SLR camera. And the flash is going off on it. And I think to myself, what the heck is this guy doing in flash mode? This is an SLR camera. You're not supposed to put an SLR camera in flash mode. Onboard flash, automatic. That's not what an SLR is for. That's what a point-and-shoot is for. And then I stopped and started to think about it. I was like, can you put your SLR camera in auto mode? Why would you do that? Are there pros? Are there cons? So I started asking questions. So I popped my head over in the forums at NAPP, the National Association of Photoshop Professionals. And I asked around. I was like, what's going on here? Am I just a prude? Or can this really be done? Can you put your SLR camera in auto mode? Does it make sense? Why would you want to do that? Why? Why? I wanted to know why. I haven't shot in automatic mode with my SLR in years. I've got a point-and-shoot camera. Well, my wife has a point-and-shoot camera, which, of course, I've probably commandeered most of the time. So I've got a point-and-shoot camera, I've got an SLR, and I make a distinction between the two. But is that the only way? So I was asking all these questions, and I got a pretty wide range of answers there, and we're going to share a couple of them with you here on the show today. First side of it, people said absolutely. Some people don't have multiple cameras. Some people are just getting into SLR photography. They have a desire to take their photography to the next level. Is that you? Did you just get an SLR? Are you still confused about the manual and the shutters and the apertures and the P mode and the action mode and what the hell all these different things do? And, oh my God, just put it in auto until I figure all this stuff out. If that's you, then yes. Put that camera in auto mode. It can take fantastic pictures. And that's what it's all about, taking fantastic pictures. It's not about the camera. It's not about the shutters. It's not about the apertures. It's about your vision. And if you see something that you want to take a picture of, by all means, put that SLR in auto mode, make sure you can get the shot, let the camera do the work for you until you can figure out all the bells and whistles. And I had to admit, yeah, that's how I started out too. Well, maybe I just jumped the gun a little bit. So I thought, okay, well, I guess it's a good thing. I guess it can be a good thing to put your camera, your SLR camera, in auto mode. But then the question becomes, well, when do you take it off? If you can put it in auto mode and let the camera do everything for you, why would you ever want to take it off of the auto mode? Why did we get SLR cameras in the first place? And that's where we came up with the flip side of the argument. And here's the flip side. The flip side's kind of fun. Because when you've got that SLR camera, or if you're looking at getting an SLR camera, you're interested in taking your photography to the next level. And that next level is actually learning how to manage and control your aperture, your shutter speed, your ISO settings, and all these creative aspects of your camera and the wonderful things that you can do when you start looking at things from a creative standpoint, understanding all the mechanics. But first, before you can understand the mechanics, you've got to get the basics down. You've got to know where the buttons are. You've got to know what the camera can do. I know some people now that don't ever take their camera off the auto mode, primarily because they're getting higher quality pictures, they're getting larger pictures than what a point and shoot can give them, because it's a larger sensor on the SLR, and plus some people just want the interchangeable lenses. They don't want to have to do all the work. So if you don't want to do all the work, if you just want the camera to do the work for you, you just want the lenses, you just want the camera to do the work, and you just want to get creative behind that lens, by all means, leave it in the auto mode. But when you want to go past that, you might want to start exploring some of those creative zones. What does manual do? What does TV do? What does AV do? And the people that start asking these kinds of questions really want to take control of their photography and make things more malleable and really drop that depth of field down super, super narrow so only one part of that picture is in focus. And when people start wanting to do that, they're going to be forced out of that auto mode and they're going to be putting it in shutter priority or aperture priority or manual or portrait or sport or action, depending on what you want to do, or even night photography. There's a dial mode setting for night photography on pretty much every SLR camera out there. And depending on where you are, where you want to go, and what you want to do with your photography, you can be in any mode. You can be in any mode you want and accomplish what you want to accomplish in your photography. And that's the great thing about photography, is really is up to the photographer to decide what they want to do. There's no right, there's no wrong. If you capture exactly what it is you wanted to capture, who cares how you got there? Who cares how you got there? Who cares if you used a point-and-shoot camera, if you used an $800 SLR, or if you used a $5,000 SLR? If you've got the means and you want to drop some coin on some high-quality gear to know that you got really good photos out of your camera, by all means do that. Do not let that discourage you from shooting in auto mode. But for those of you that want to go past the auto mode, oh boy, can you go past the auto mode. Like I said, you can get really creative in your depth of field. You can get super fast with your shutter speed. You can go super slow with your shutter speed and get a little blur going on. All depends on what you want to do. Do you want to flash the light from on camera? Do you want to move the flash off camera? Different positions will have different effects, and that's what makes it all so much fun and so exciting. So there's kind of the hook for you for this week, is that it really depends. It depends on what you want to do. Depends on where you are in the learning curve. If you're an accomplished professional, say you're a wedding photographer, and you don't need to know all the settings because you know the camera does a great job without you making all the fancy adjustments and changes, slap it into auto mode if you're comfortable with that. Just keep in mind that there are creative things that you can do outside of that mode, and you don't want to fear that. You don't want to be afraid of that, because if you are afraid of that, then you might actually be better served by leaving it in auto and not letting that get in your way. So that is kind of the storyline behind moving the dial on that SLR camera. We're going to come back in just a few minutes. I'm going to talk about what each of these sections does and when you can use one over the other. But before I do that, I want to introduce you to Matthew Bamberg. I had a sit-down conversation with him earlier this week. Talked to him about his background in photography, what got him started, where he is, how he got into writing books. He's a great author. I've actually seen a couple of his books online. I'm going to have a chance to take a look at him here soon. And he's actually going to share one for one of our monthly giveaways. So he's going to be getting some books out to us, and we're going to give one away in an upcoming photography contest. Ooh. hey, photography contest coming up at Learning Digital Photography. Who'd have thunk it? But we're going to sit down and talk to him after this, so I'll be back in just a minute with Matthew Bamberg. Today I have Matthew Bamberg. Matthew Bamberg is a pretty well-known author in the photography community. He's got quite a few books out. You can find them over on Amazon.com. One of his better titles that I'm familiar with is The 50 Greatest Photo Opportunities in San Francisco. He's got some other books as well. Another good one is 101 Quick and Easy Secrets to Creating Winning Photographs. Matt, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Well, it's great to have you on. I'd like to talk to you a little bit about your background. What started you getting into taking pictures and also into the book writing? I'll go ahead and let you start things off, and then we'll go back and forth with a couple questions. So, why don't you tell us a little bit about your background?
Okay. I got started in photography when I was getting my master's degree at San Francisco State, and I first started with video production. And then I started working with still images when I was doing slideshows for my final master's project. And as far as getting started writing books, I just had this goal that I wanted to write a book. And I had, at the time, I was involved in selling my photographs to different stores in Southern California. And the photographs were of mid-century motel signs, and they kind of got to be a big hit here because of the mid-century modern architecture that we have in Palm Springs and Los Angeles.
Right,
and a lot of people were buying them. And then the agency called that I called, asking me if I wanted to write a book. Well, first they asked me if I'm a working photographer, and I said yes. And then they asked me if I wanted to write a book. Well, at first I asked them, and then then they said, okay, we're going to call so-and-so at Wiley. And before I knew it, I was on the phone talking about a book deal.
Wow, that's excellent. That's awesome. And the 101 Quick and Easy Secrets to Creating the Winning Photographs book looks like a really useful resource for any aspiring photographer. Was that the first book that you had published, the 101 Quick and Easy
Secrets? No, the first one was in 2005. It was Digital Art Photography for Dummies.
Okay, I didn't see that one in the list you had sent me.
Yeah, I don't include it anymore because it's kind of old.
Oh, okay. Well, we might want to throw a link to that over on Amazon just in case there is interest from the readership. And you said you were getting your master's degree. What was your master's degree in photography as well, or video arts? Or
no, I ended up getting my master's degree in creative arts.
Oh, creative arts. Okay. So it kind of seemed to both of them pretty well there.
Right.
Excellent.
I did work in the visual arts.
Okay, and what kind of work were you doing before you decided to go into authoring and photography full-time?
Oh, well, being a photographer kind of came by accident.
It always does.
I had moved to Palm Springs from San Francisco, and I wanted to be a writer.
Oh, okay.
And so I applied to a couple of newspapers, and one of them got interested in one of my articles, so I ended up writing for it. And she came over one day, and at the time the article was called Confessions of a Picker. A picker is somebody who goes out and buys antiques or mid-century modern items and then resells them. And I had started doing that because I was interested in it, and I had all this stuff at my house, and she started taking photographs of it. And then I just kind of watched her, and I go, I think I could do that. And that was that. She kind of brought me into photography with my writing. So from then on, and I always submitted photographs with my writing.
Oh, so you kind of have the two seam together there, where you're doing writing and photography work
right
in conjunction with one another.
That's why I'm writing photography books now, because I'm a pretty adept writer.
Excellent, excellent. Yeah, and it looks like you got some great books. And I noticed you had said when we were exchanging emails that you actually have a new book that's coming out this fall, correct? This winter, actually.
Right, in December. It's 101 Quick and Easy Ideas Taken from Master Photographers of the 20th Century.
Excellent, excellent. And that's due, you said, in December?
Yeah, I'm real excited about it because that was like a big project trying to emulate close to 40 different master photographers. And at first I didn't think I could do it. I didn't know what I was going to do. But just I gradually just took one thing from a couple of photos from each photographer and looked at, kind of figured out what they did in their photography that was different from what other people did. And then I took a photograph with that one thing and for each of the photographers, and it ended up, I'm almost done.
Wow, that's awesome. Looking forward to seeing that. Did you have a specific place where you started? Like you said, it's at the 20th century. So did you start like from the beginning of the 20th century and then say, okay, I'm going to look starting with Ansel Adams, or looking at, like, did you go alphabetically? How did you select?
Yeah, I went alphabetically. I have Brassari and Robert Boissonneau and some of the French ones, mm-hmm. who were first, because over in Europe, I think there was more going on before it came over to the United States.
Sure.
So some of the earlier photographers are French.
Excellent, excellent. Can you give us any teasers of who else is going to be in your book?
Oh, yeah. There's the youngest person in my book is Stephen Shore. I don't know if you've ever heard of him.
Sounds familiar.
He does kind of the out and out places. When he was 24, I guess he's near 60 now, he went out on the road and took photos of 70s America. And it's pretty like, for example, one of his images is of a Sambo's parking lot. And wow. Just a parking lot. And wow. You wouldn't think there was anything good about that. But when you started looking at the image, there was all kinds of cool cars. The colors were the 70s, the bad tans and bad greens. And it just worked. And
yeah.
His images were like that.
And you had actually mentioned, didn't you say something that you were doing some kind of similar work in your background as well? Were you doing some 70s themed stuff as well?
Right. I had become real familiar with it from when I was reselling the mid-century modern items.
Right, so right.
I knew the art of it.
Right, that's pretty cool. And it's kind of interesting how all that segues into one another. So you probably got some inspiration from him in that regard too, right?
Right.
Cool, very cool.
And then I have Paul Strand, Stieglitz.
Stieglitz. Tomato, tomato.
Tina Modotti and Weston.
Oh, Weston. Okay, excellent, excellent. Wow, you got some biggies on that list.
I include all the meat of it, too, the relationships and who everybody was. Back then, everybody was friends with everybody, and mm-hmm. everybody knew everybody. It was like a really tight community, not like it is now where everybody's off in their own direction.
Now, do you think that has helped or hurt the industry where people are off in their own direction these days?
I think it's made it pretty scattered. I think the creativity isn't – I mean, there are a lot of good photographers, and I think that right now with this digital photography that everybody's concentrating so much on the technical aspects of it. Mm-hmm. They're forgetting about the creativity, like what went back in – what like what they used back then.
Right.
They're kind of not getting into composition as much.
I've seen a little bit of that myself too when I'm looking at other people where it seems like a lot of the – like you said, people get, you know, hung up on the technical. How many megapixels do you have? You know, how sharp is it? Did you run Noise Ninja on that? Did you run this, you know, action on that? You know, what'd you do to adjust it?
Right.
You know, instead of looking at the compositional aspect. It's interesting. Great stuff. Great stuff. Well, one of the things I wanted to ask you about, because you had said that you're doing your own photography work in conjunction with your writing, what kind of gear do you use to take your pictures with? Are you more on the film side? Or are you digital now? Or what kind of stuff do you used to shoot with?
I started out with film, and now that I've ended this book, I've kind of ended it on which is better, film or digital, because I've looked at so many film images.
Sure.
And those guys back then shot with 8x10 large format cameras.
Sure.
And of course the pictures they shot were of course much better than digital, because it was such a big native. They don't have an 8x10 sensor, and I don't ever think they will.
Right.
After looking at my old film images that I had scanned, they kind of looked really cool. There was just that something, that grain or that smoothness that's not there with digital.
Right.
And
yeah.
Digital is always like you have a chance of overblowing your overblown highlights and real big dark spots, and it's kind of hard to balance out.
Yeah, it's interesting about that. I've seen a couple actions come out that are trying to duplicate or replicate the noise that was familiar to those of us that had started back in the film eras. And They're
yeah, I just
pretty...
read about that. There's a program that'll make your digital photographs look like film.
Which is kind of funny because now it's going back a little ways trying to reproduce it when you can actually go out and still get the film.
Right.
It's like, you know, go back to the original. That does it too. And yeah. You don't need an after effect in Photoshop.
Really? On my blog, I just I had found a little clip, a video clip of two people that got together and shot with a Nikon digital and a Nikon film, and then they blew up the image to wall size to see which was better. And, of course, digital was better because there was just more I don't know why digital was better. When they blew it up, the color contrast wasn't as good with film as it was with digital. And of course, when you blew up the film, you got the grain, and you could see it.
Right, yeah, it's kind of interesting how people are always looking at, you know, how sharp things are. Did you get rid of all the noise in your photographs and things like that? And especially I think the web has had a huge impact on the on how discerning people are and what people are looking at in terms of photography, where they're looking at how clean it is, you know, is there noise in there? How sharp is it? And they say, well, you know, try a print every now and then. Those can look good too.
Right. That's true. And you know, sometimes that stuff doesn't matter.
Right.
It's I went to a show at UCLA and the images were digital and they did have some, you know, all white areas in their photos. And it's like, wow, I've been getting so, you know, I've been trying to digitally manipulate so I don't have these blown highlights when I really don't have to do that.
Right.
And also, I don't have to get rid of those spots in my pictures because they're kind of interesting.
Yeah, kind of. It can definitely add to it if it's the compositional approach that you're going for.
Right.
And your blog is where at? You mentioned you have a blog?
It's 101quickandeasysecrets.wordpress.com.
Okay, cool. I'll go ahead and link to that in the show notes. Tell you what, we're going to take a quick break and we'll come back and finish up our discussion with Matthew Bamberg here at Learning Digital Photography. Welcome back. We're still here talking with Matthew Bamberg. He's a well-known author and photographer, and a couple other of his books that we wanted to talk about, especially given the time of year. There were three main books. I guess the fourth one, you said the one that's coming out is the Master Photographer's one, correct?
Right.
That's one that's due out this December?
Right.
The one I wanted to ask you about was the one where you mentioned using your digital photographs, because it seems like with the holiday season coming up, that might be actually one to really take a good look at for some of the readers and listeners for the blog and podcast. Would you mind going into a little more detail on what that book covers?
Right, the first thing that comes to mind is Zazzle.com, which lets you make coffee cups with your photos. And they have a little system on their site where you can view your photo on the coffee cup or view your photo on the t-shirt. And
cool.
The prices aren't that bad considering you're going to be using your own photography on the stuff, and they make great gifts. So that's just one of the items I have in using your digital photographs. I also tell how I became a writer, and I give the agency I went through and the whole process I went through to write photography how-to books.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. And I give a lot of helpful ideas for just getting your photographs out there. Magazines, newspapers, the whole websites, the whole nine yards.
Oh, very cool. Very cool. So it's not just about how to use your digital photographs. It's about how to get your photographs published, get them out there for people viewing, and about how to segue into the writing industry if people are so inclined as well.
Right.
Excellent.
Exactly.
Excellent. And that book is The 101 Quick and Easy Secrets for Using Your Digital Photographs, available over at Amazon.com. So the last book that I wanted to ask you about was that first one you had mentioned, the 50 Greatest Photo Opportunities in San Francisco.
Yeah,
go ahead.
Running up and down those hills.
Oh, I'm sure. That's not an easy town to walk around, that's for sure.
You know, especially with all the equipment and everything. But I met a lot of nice people on the way, and
cool.
Even the homeless people were really nice. All I had to do is just tell them firmly, look, I'm working.
Sure, just put your foot down kind of thing. And on the cover of that, you've got an excellent shot. What is that, the Golden Gate?
Right.
That's the Golden Gate on the cover. That's a great shot. Is that one of the ones you recommend inside the book?
Oh, yes. And I tell you where to go and how to get there, and cool. As well as there's some spots to do the Bay Bridge, the Oakland Bay Bridge. And there's just so many places to go. I couldn't name them all here, but
can you give us a couple?
Levi Plaza has some great photo ops and gardens. That's right on the Embarcadero,
right,
which used to be the Embarcadero Freeway. I like the Japanese Tea Garden in Golden Gate Park.
Cool.
I got some great shots there.
Excellent.
And the surfers on Ocean Beach. And you know how in some of those 20th century photographers always wanted to make little people look small.
Mm-hmm.
And you can get up in good and get good vantage points to where you see everything really small, and you just have this vast beach of with the ocean on it and just all these little tiny people. And it just makes for a real compelling image.
Right, great sense of scale, that's for sure. Yeah,
right.
Sounds awesome. And do you also recommend like times of day, like what the best time of day is to go shoot from this angle in this location? Do you go into that level of detail too?
It has a little icon for the time of day.
Nice.
Nice.
And then you said you also give directions, so there's like little maps or guides in there too?
Yeah, there's directions by mass transit and directions, it's kind of like a travel book, and directions by driving.
Cool. Very cool. I'll definitely have to check that one out. My cousin actually lives in San Francisco, and we went out for his wedding. We hit, Pier 39 or 39th Pier.
That's a great place to take photos. They have that merry-go-round.
Yeah.
Those performers. It's wonderful.
Yeah, that was a lot of fun getting there. Didn't get a chance to see a lot more of San Francisco when we were there because we were there for the wedding, obviously.
Uh-huh.
But what little we did saw, I just knew I wanted to go back. So I'll definitely have to get a copy of your book and take it with me the next time we go out. That definitely is a great read. Just out of curiosity, then, as kind of a wrapping up point, in doing all the photography work that you've done and doing all the writing work that you've done, how do you go about getting sources of creativity or sources of inspiration as you move forward and go down future paths? Like this one for the greatest photographers from the master photographers from 20th century. You know, what prompted that? You know, what kind of stuff do you look for to find inspiration and creativity?
I go to the grittiest neighborhoods at sundown.
Grittiest. So you like grit and sundown. Okay.
Yeah. I mean,
gritty sundowns.
That's what it all comes down to, is you want all the patinaed stuff, the stuff that's old and peeling, as well as the characters on the street. And
get the texture.
Any given moment. That's what they did back then.
Right. That's definitely cool. And I think that definitely adds a flavor of texture that you wouldn't get from other scenes or other times of day.
Right. I got a good story. Helen Levitt, all she did was photograph children, and she didn't even like children.
But you do like the sundown. You like the grit, right?
Oh, yeah. Very much so. Especially in play.
Definitely. Got any cool anecdotes that you can share with the listening audience?
Yeah, so I always go to third world zoos. The one in Morelia, Mexico is great, and the one in Rangoon, Myanmar. Everybody knows it's Burma, but they think it's Myanmar.
Right.
It's getting too political. But anyway, there was a little Buddhist boy who was in his orange robe and everything, and he ended up taking my friend and I all around to the zoo, and he knew everything. It was just amazing. And he took me to places where I wouldn't have gone. And the animals there, you can touch them. You can feed them. You can look inside the hippo's mouths. And
wow.
It's just incredible. They just don't have any rules there.
And where was this again?
In Myanmar.
Oh, okay. Okay, so it wasn't in California. This was actually traveling.
I think the worst zoo to photograph in is the San Diego Zoo, because you just can't get to the animals.
I think most U.S. zoos are like that, where it's just you're going to have to get real close to the fence and throw it out of focus on your front end of your lens there, which is a little unfortunate.
I've had people disagree with me on that on my blog, but you know, if you get there at the right time and they're doing the right thing, then it's okay.
Yeah, it all depends on, and that's I think a lot of what photography is about is patience and timing.
Mm-hmm.
And you got to be in the right place at the right time, and you got to have the patience to go back to places frequently so you can get the right place and the right time
exactly.
And the right lighting and all that. So you mentioned you were in Burma. Have you done any other travel photography
I've been to Argentina, Uruguay. I've got some great shots there. All the third world countries are great. Mexico.
Sure.
Let me see, where else? The Eastern Europe's real good.
Excellent. Wow, you've done quite a bit of traveling. Have you thought of putting a book together about the third world photography and maybe some tips and tricks there to share?
Hey, that's an idea. I have a book that never got published called The Book of Signs of 20th Century, and it's all signs, but never went anywhere.
Yeah, well, it's definitely something we could look forward to if you were so inclined. Well, Matt, thank you so much for taking the time to sit down and talk with us here at Learning Digital Photography. If you had three little tips or tricks that you wanted to share for really how to capture good photos, probably taken from the 101 Quick and Easy Secrets to Create Winning Photographs. If you could pick your top three tips or tricks from that book, which
one? If you're running after a photo op, you're actually running, make sure you stop all the way before you take the picture. I don't know how many times I've got a soft picture from taking the picture while I'm running.
Lots of blur, sure.
Yeah.
So I guess that kind of begs another question before moving to the last two. So do you primarily shoot handheld then? Are you more of a handheld shooter?
Yeah, I shoot handheld. I did a lot of tripod work in the San Francisco book.
Oh, okay. Okay.
But a lot of it, my favorite is candid photography.
Yeah, where you kind of run and gun, you got to go handheld because they're not going to stop while you set up your tripod, put your automatic bracketing on.
And then everything's gone.
Got
a tip. Another thing that you need to do is make sure you look over a scene that you think is interesting very closely, because I got a story for you.
Oh, okay.
When I went to Silver Lake to a street fair, and there were two people sitting on a bus bench, right?
Okay.
And I took the picture, and then I went home, and had I looked closely, there was this big eye in between the two people.
Oh, my God. And
I was able to crop it out, so, you know, like there's these five eyes in the picture, four from the people and one right in the middle from the picture of the face behind them.
Like an eyeball? Like a
big eyeball, and it's just such, you know, that's candid photography.
Wow. Wow, yeah, definitely look the scene over for that kind of detail. That would definitely.
Yeah, and I wish I had gotten in, you know, closer and you know, been more observant when I was at when I was at the location.
So I guess that's more of a tip to sweat the small stuff there then, right?
Right.
Definitely. Great tip. All right, one more tip before we head out for the day.
Oh, one more tip.
One more tip and one more story.
Oh, make sure you bring all your lenses with you on a trip.
Okay.
Don't get lazy and bring your lightest camera.
Okay, and why would that be? Do you have an anecdote to share there too?
Yeah, because my telephoto lens is really heavy, and my D5, that with my D5 is kind of aggravating, annoying to carry, but, you know, I manage.
Right.
And for example, I was at this really funky neighborhood in L.A., and it was sunset, and there were these really cool white birds on top of a roof, and I had my L-series lens that only went out to 105 millimeters, and I was only able to take a long shot of it, and I wanted to really get in there and get the birds because they were gorgeous.
So always take all your gear with you. And if you'd only have one lens, then I guess that makes things a lot easier too.
Right.
They say the best lens is the lens you have with you. So if you have all your lenses with you, you've got that many more options.
There you go.
Excellent. And you said you had an L lens. Does that mean you're shooting with Canon gear?
Yeah, all Canon.
Hey, look at that. A fellow Canon shooter. That's awesome.
Nikon's good, but I just never got there.
Yeah, and you know what? These days, the way I hear people talking about Canon versus Nikon versus Sony and Pentax, it's really not the gear. It's really who's behind the gear that matters.
That's true. I agree with you 100%.
And I have to say that the person behind the gear in your books and in your photography there is definitely a good source of creative inspiration. You've got some great work out there, Matt.
Thank you.
Oh, and thank you for coming on the blog. It's been a lot of fun talking to you. This is Matthew Bamberg. You can find his work over on Amazon.com. The four books are 101 Quick and Easy Secrets to Create Winning Photographs. Book number two is 101 Quick and Easy Secrets for Using Your Digital Photographs. Book number three, The 50 Greatest Photo Opportunities in San Francisco. And Matthew, the fourth one that's coming up this winter is?
101 Quick and Easy Ideas Taken from Master Photographers of the 20th Century.
And that's due out in December, you said?
December 15th, hopefully.
We've got a date from you, too, December 15th. And people can find you and follow you over on your website, 101quickandeasysecrets.wordpress.com.
Yeah, and if they can't remember that, MatthewBamberg.com.
MatthewBamberg.com, right. Are you on Twitter at all? Do you do any of the social networking?
On Twitter, I'm Matthew Bam.
Matthew Bam, okay. Okay, any other outlets like Facebook or anything like that that you use to promote your work or –
No, I'm just on Facebook, just gathering friends and being social, trying to get out here in Palm Springs and have some fun.
Oh, and you've got a Flickr page too, I just noticed.
Yeah, I do have Flickr. I have them all. After writing that Using Photographs, I went to every website. I went to the Family Tree website, just all of them that you can think of, and I had to sign up and go through it so I could explain to people how you do these things.
Okay, I guess we were signing out, but you just said the family seek. What is it? The family?
Oh, there's family a tree there's site? A family tree website that you can build. At I can't remember the web address, but if you type in "build a family tree website," you can find it.
Okay, we'll definitely find that and throw that to the link in the show notes as well. So, building family trees, building Flickr albums, building photo albums and photo books, all from today's show with Matthew Bamberg. Matt, thanks so much for stopping and taking the time to talk to us. We really appreciate it.
Thank you very much, Jason.
Welcome back to Learning Digital Photography. That was a great conversation we had with Matthew Bamberg, so thanks again to him for stopping in to talk to us here at Learning Digital Photography. I do encourage you to go over and check out his books over at Amazon.com, as well as some of his photo galleries. He's really got some great stuff out there. Thanks to Matthew for sitting in with us here at LDP. For our final segment, we're going to take some listener questions and answers. Our first question comes to us from... who was it? Let me get her name. It was some girl... I think her name was Crystal. Crystal, here it is. Here's the questions for this week's show. Yes, it comes to us from Crystal. Crystal writes in and says, Jason, you're a wonderful photographer. We think you're the bee's knees. Thank you. No, she doesn't say that. Nobody says that. Her question is about daguerreotype photography. It's daguerreotype. I think I'm saying that. I don't know if it's daguerreau or doggerreau or daguerreotype. It's D-A-G-U-E-R-R-E-O type photography. It actually refers to a photography process, Crystal. It's a great question. I'm going to go into a little more detail on that, give you a little bit of the history. And see, this is really cool because this stuff was happening when photography was still new. Still new. I'm not talking digital photography. I'm talking photography. We're talking like 100 years ago, 150 years ago, 200 years ago. This is like the 1800s. What was it? 1839? Did I read 1839? It's a long time ago, laddie. Yes, it was 1839 when Louis Daguerre, he was a French chemist, so I took a little bit of French, I should have known that, but he's a French chemist, and he basically perfected this process, and basically this process for taking pictures, he got a highly polished mirror, and they coated it with this chemical. It was silver halide, I think was the chemical they used, and why they used silver halide is because silver halide is light sensitive. So they prepped this highly polished mirror beforehand, they'd plop it in behind the lens, and then they would expose the scene that they want to capture. And this light-sensitive silver halide would darken when exposed to light. So you would kind of get a negative of the image that you're trying to capture, but then it got reflected onto this highly polished surface. So by treating, by going into the post-production, or the fixer, if you will, because they had to go through fixer back then, just like they did with film days. There was a fixer that would complete the process to put the image on that highly polished surface, and that would turn it back into a positive image, because the silver halide would be a negative because it darkened. So when that reflected onto the highly polished mirror, that would turn it back into a positive image. And it was really quite amazing for the time, if you think about this. The 1800s, 1839. And actually, most of you have probably seen a daguerreotype image before in your life, because one of the first photographs that was ever done of President Abraham Lincoln was done using daguerreotype photography. And what made it cool, what made this really cool, is it really shortened the amount of time that was needed for doing portrait work. Because before these light-sensitive chemicals, they didn't have the sensitivity there to distinguish between light and dark. So they had to take people's pictures by having them sit for a long time. So you could get some blur if the person moved, if the person sneezed, when, you know, whatever happened, you know, it was subject to so much error. So by discovering these light-sensitive chemicals, they actually shortened the process quite a bit. So exposure times didn't have to be as long as they used to. And they actually improved upon that, too, from daguerreotype. They also started using, what was it, bromine and chlorine later down the road? Yeah, here is the daguerreotype. Did become the first commercially viable photographic process in that it was the first to permanently record and fix an image with exposure times compatible with portrait photography. but this was after extra sensitizing agents, bromine and chlorine, were added to Daguerre's original process. So the process was completed by Daguerre, and they just improved upon that, as things have tended to do in photography. They just improved upon that with time, but that's what daguerreotype photography is. It really refers to the process of capturing an image, a negative image, on light-sensitive chemicals, and then reflecting that onto a highly polished mirror surface. Louis Daguerre perfected the process back in the 1800s. Tinotype is very similar to that, too. So for those of you that are familiar with tinotype, I believe that's a similar process as well. So that was a great question coming in from Crystal. Thank you, Crystal, for your question. Wow, very alliterative today, because guess what? The next question comes to us from Christopher. He spells it with a K, too. Maybe he's German. Guten Tag, Christopher. Thank you for your question. Christopher's question is actually about scanners. And this is kind of a cool question, too, because he's asking, what's a good scanner to go out and capture your images? So I'm guessing what Christopher is talking about is going through an archive of old film pictures that were taken in previous years and archiving them, turning them into digital images. And if that is correct, I would actually recommend any consumer-grade scanner. Really, the consumer-grade scanners that are out there these days are just amazing. The one I started out with was an Epson V200 Perfection scanner. It cost me, $150 two or three years ago, and I couldn't give it away on eBay now. So if anyone wants an Epson Perfection scanner, send me an email. You'll get a really good price on a scanner. I'll just ask you to pay for basically shipping and handling, maybe $5 or $10 or whatever, and you can get a really good scanner. So, Christopher, if you want this scanner, shoot me an email. If anyone else wants this scanner, you can shoot me an email as well, jason@canonblogger.com. Reason why I'm not using it is because I've actually upgraded. My old HP printer died, and I upgraded to a new Epson V300, which is an all-in-one, which includes a scanner. And I don't really need two scanners. I don't do a lot of scanning. So I have an extra Epson V200, but pretty much any commercial-grade scanner will suffice if you're just looking to archive digital images. Now, there are more advanced scanners out there. There's drum scanners that can just reproduce amazing quality. Heck, you can even take a box, a shoebox of images over to Walgreens if you don't want to buy a scanner and have them do it for you. But if you want to get a little more control over the process of capturing the images digitally and making sure things are adjusted for each specific image type, I would recommend getting your own. You can get them very cheaply for $100. And then you have it for all time. And the cool thing about scanners is there's actually a lens in there, so you can use it as a camera. I've seen people take computer parts, and they'll put their computer parts down on the scanner in various positions and at various angles, scan that, and they're creating an image. You can take dried flowers and put those on your scanner, scan that in, and you're creating an image. You're still creating an image, and it's actually a pretty cool type of photography. There's probably a couple of Flickr groups out there that specialize in scanned images as a form of artistic expression. So if anyone knows of any of those, feel free to link to the comments over on the blog or share a comment with me here at Personal Life Media or in iTunes. I always like getting comments and feedback. Nice to know what people like, nice to know what people don't like about the show. The last question that comes into us, and thank you to Christopher for writing in. Our last question, believe it or not, comes from someone named Kevin. Kevin in Colorado, actually. Wow, a lot of alliteration today. Kevin writes in basically asking about Windows 7. For those of you that may not be aware, Microsoft came out with its latest operating system. This is Windows 7. This is the latest and greatest operating system that Microsoft has come out with. And he's asking whether or not it's going to be worthwhile to upgrade to Windows 7. I guess he's running XP at this point for photography work, if it will work better with photography software. I have to say, in all honesty, Kevin, I don't know that you'll see much of a difference from the operating system perspective. One of the benefits of these newer operating systems, the Vistas and the Windows 7 and the Mac OS X's and things of that nature, is they can actually have 64-bit versions of their operating system, which means you can address more memory. Prior to the 64-bit OS operating system, you can only address up to, 3.5 gigs in Windows, or 2 gigs or 4 gigs. You had a limit into what could be addressed in a 32-bit OS. So with these new advances in operating system technology, 64-bit is going to become the norm, because you can address up to 32 or 64 gigabytes of RAM, just insane amounts of RAM. And that's going to help if you're doing a lot of 3D stuff. So if you're taking photos or you're doing video inside of Photoshop and things of that nature where there's really like a lot of image data that you're manipulating either in Photoshop or GIMP or Lightroom or wherever you're having me going with your work. So if you've got an OS that can address more memory, you may want to take that into consideration if you're doing a lot of high-end work. If you're not doing high-end work, it really isn't going to matter too much which operating system you're on. You're just going to have to go with the ones that you feel most comfortable with. Some, I'm not going to get into the whole Windows versus Mac thing. I know the Mac fans out there are going to say Mac is better because of this, this, and that. The Windows fans out there will say Windows is better because of this, this, and that. The networking, the handling, it just works kind of thing. I don't want to get into all that whole argument there. The one thing I have heard about Windows 7, I heard from Leo Laporte, the tech guy, over on Tech Guy Labs, or TWIT, This Week in Photography. He's got a podcast that comes out every weekend if you are interested at all in learning about other types of technology. The Tech Guy podcast is one I could highly recommend. But Leo was talking about Windows 7 as Vista Service Pack 2. He's saying it's basically Vista. It's just they made a lot of improvements. They got rid of the user account, security alert warnings. They took that out. They improved the quality. They improved the interface a lot. Took away a lot of the bad stuff, made the good stuff better, that kind of thing. So it's a new and improved version of Vista, according to the Leo over at Tech Guy Labs. I actually heard that from my boss today at work, who was running a beta version of Windows 7 on his computer at the office to see whether or not we're going to be upgrading to it. Don't have an answer on whether or not our systems will be upgraded, but from what I've heard and read about it, it sounds like it's actually going to be a pretty good operating system as far as being able to handle the needs of the aging computers that are in the marketplace today. Of computer users that are in the marketplace today where their systems are just getting too old for them and they want to get a new one. Whether or not they should get Windows 7 or get a Mac is really a matter of personal preference. I do know that Windows 7 probably is ready for prime time. So if you're interested in getting a new computer and you don't want to spend the money on a Mac, Windows 7 is definitely worth taking a good look at here. So thank you to everyone for writing in to Crystal, Christopher, and Kevin for the cool questions of Canon Blogger. Gotta love alliteration. Those are the questions for this week. Oh, the last thing I want to talk about is the contest. That's right. We just finished out the October contest. Congratulations to Karen Stanzel, a.k.a. Mitz. For those of you that have been keeping up on the blog and the Twitter sphere and the inner sphere and the internet sphere and all the spheres out there, Karen is actually Mitz online. And she actually is a good friend. I found out after I selected the winner that this was her image, so it's kind of cool. Just a great image. Really fit the theme well. She kept it simple. Great bokeh in her image. Nice out of focus. Great work at depth of field. Just really a fantastic image. Congratulations to her for winning the October contest. She won a copy of Noise Ninja from the folks over at Picture Code. So congratulations to her. And now for the November contest, which is going to start next week. So I'm going to create a thread over on the Flickr forums for Learning Digital Photography. You got to join Learning Digital Photography if you want to participate. But basically what you do is you go into the Flickr thread, share your photos in there. You've got about 3 weeks to take pictures, capture pictures, and post them inside the Flickr thread. And the theme for this month's contest is winter. Last month was fall, so surprise, surprise, we're going to have a winter theme for the November contest. And what are you going to win? What's in it for you? What's in it for you is a free book from Matthew Bamberg. From our interview, you've heard all about his books. You're going to get a free copy of one of Matthew Bamberg's books, gratis, shipped to you directly, for winning the November contest. So that is what's going to go out to the winner. There may be something else in there coming to you from me as well, since we're getting near holidays and giveaways and things like that. Maybe a little extra something-something in there for the winner of the contest. No guarantees. No guarantees. Have to see where things are, but maybe a gift card or something might throw its way in there. Who knows what's going to happen. But the winner will definitely be getting a copy of Matthew Bamberg's book, so you want to make sure to get your images in. 3 images per person, as always. And one little tip for you, you want to make sure that you're getting in images that have a dimension between 600 and 800 pixels for one of those available. I saw some from the last month where that dimension size wasn't met. It was either too small or too large. Didn't fit within that window, so I had to exclude it. And you also want to make sure that I can download it. If I can't download it, then I can't look at them in Lightroom, because that's how I look at the photos. I download a copy of it, and I I put them all together in a single folder. Then I upload everything into the Lightroom and look at all the pictures. Boom, 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 boom. And I pick out 10%, roughly, for the finalists. So those are the finalists. And then from the finalists, I'll pick out a winner. Or one of the vendors will pick out a winner or whatever. But basically, we download them into a gallery and we create a gallery and we review the gallery for the finalists and the eventual winner. So if we can't download it, then you're not going to be considered. So you want to make sure that you don't have to make everyone able to download. You can just put me in as an authorized person to download your photos from Flickr. I'm not going to steal them. I'm not going to violate any kind of copyright. I always have been a respecter of copyright. I always will be. Once the contest is done, the images get deleted. I don't even look at them again after that, other than to create the finalist gallery for posting over on the blog, which is another reason why you want to make it downloadable, because you can get actually a little bit of visibility that way too. So get your photos in for the winter themed contest. Make sure you're following the theme of winter. Make sure your image is between 600 and 800 pixels on the longest dimension, and make sure I can download it and have a lot of fun, because that is what photography is all about. So that pretty much wraps up the show for this week. Don't forget about that dial. Don't forget about taking it to the auto mode, seeing what you can do from there, and see what the differences are between auto, TV, AVM, and the picture head, and the action figure, and the little night star in there, and see what all the different modes do, and find the one that works best for you. Because whichever one works best for you is going to create the best pictures, and you'll have the most fun with it, and that is what it's all about. Thanks for listening, everyone. I will see you next time here at Learning Digital Photography. Have a good weekend. Bye.